Welcome to Mentoring Moments. Mentoring Moments is a sub-series of the E-Commerce Edge podcast. It is composed of clips taken from Jason's one-to-one and group mentorship sessions. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is my absolute pleasure to welcome Alex back from Couch.com. Welcome, Alex.
Thank you so much for having me, Jason. It's great to be here.
Mate, it is so awesome to have you along for the ride today as one of our guests. And you are based in the large, beautiful, well-known city of Los Angeles, about 40 minutes west of where I was raised, which is in Riverside, California. And we were just, my wife and I were just there. We were just doing a road trip. We did a road trip. We did Phoenix. I was there on business in Phoenix. Then we did Sedona, Red Rock. And we flew to San Diego, drove, got a rental car, drove all the way up the coast as far north as basically Malibu, went into LA, spent a couple of days in LA, spent a couple of days in Riverside, and then drove to Las Vegas. So just recently in your neck of the woods, in fact, just a week ago in your neck of the woods.
Why didn't you say hi? That's unbelievable.
I know. Little did I know. Little did I know.
That's quite a trip. My God, that's awesome. Good for you.
Yeah, it was about 17, 18 days all up, I think it was. And it was a fantastic trip. My wife had never been. My wife's a Kiwi, and she'd never been to Phoenix. She'd never been to California. She'd never been to Vegas. So she'd never seen my hometown or where I grew up or where I went to school or anything like that. So it was a fantastic trip, and only her second time to the U.S. Her first time was I was speaking at a conference, a B2B e-commerce conference in Florida in October of last year, and she came with me, and that was her first trip to the U.S. So this is now her second trip to the U.S. So it was a fantastic journey.
I love showing people stuff, like showing people around is one of my favorite things. That would be amazing to take somebody. Actually, I just brought my girlfriend to New York where I'm from, showed her around Brooklyn and things like that in the city and my favorite places. It's like I would rather do nothing else. That's really fun. Good for you guys.
It is fun. It is fun. And definitely the next time I'm in LA, we'll absolutely look you up. And before we get into Couch.com, and I'd love to hear the story about how you got that bloody domain name. That's super lucky. That's what they call a golden domain, I think. I'm sure there's an interesting story behind that. But before you started Couch.com, you owned Apartment2B or APT2B, and you founded that, you exited that, you stayed with the company after it was purchased. You 7x the growth under the new ownership as well, and you exited that business in January of 2023, and now you've been running Couch.com for almost a year now. But what we wanted to get you on to talk about today, and hopefully be, because this is an area where I absolutely am not an expert. And so I always love getting guest mentors on that are experts in areas that I am not, so I can ask all the dumb questions on behalf of my audience. And what we want to talk about today is how AI is changing the furniture game. And I have some experience. I've had clients that have worked in the furniture space before, so merchants, both physical and online, that have worked in the furniture space. I've consulted to furniture retailers before, so I have a little bit of a background in the industry. I understand some of the complexities of doing e-commerce in the furniture space. But what we really want to talk about is AI and the furniture space. But before we dig into all that, tell me about your business that you exited, and then tell me how and why you decided to start Couch.com.
Absolutely. Apartment2B, my former company, was a sort of traditional retail model, D2C, online furniture brand. We were online only. We had no store locations. And we started at a time in 2010 where this was very much uncharted territory. We were one of the pioneers in our own small and humble way of the independent furniture e-commerce game. At that time, not even brands like IKEA, the largest furniture retailer in the world, were transacting business online. This was only 14 years ago. So that's how far we've come. But no one was really putting in their credit card information for larger purchases. People didn't feel comfortable, and it wasn't socially accepted. So initially, our first big hurdle to cross is just getting people to feel comfortable enough to make an online purchase of this magnitude. Then, of course, over the years, that evolved and we got better at doing what we were doing. And luckily, we had other major players with lots of money like Wayfair telling customers and training them that this is something that was normal. Like every time I saw a Wayfair ad on television telling people that like this is a very much a normal thing to do, just as if you were going to a furniture store, even though they're technically a competitor, I was like, this is literally free advertising for my company. So we basically bootstrapped this company, learned along the way, and grew it on the Shopify platform with the partners that, you know, in the shop, if you're in the Shopify verse or Shopiverse, you know exactly which partners I'm talking about. And we got in there early. Like we were early adopters of Shopify, built the company up to a place where it was attractive to other buyers because we were able to achieve a profitable business model in e-commerce furniture. That ain't easy, I can assure you. And our company was acquired by a large furniture retail chain. So this retail chain is primarily brick and mortar. They had 30 huge stores across the Midwestern US, and they acquired us to like up their online game and invest in a youngish company that was doing something different, but in the same sphere where they could help. So it was a very successful partnership where they provided us the operational infrastructure to grow our business and bring it to new heights. And we offered them a new take and perspective on things and that they hadn't seen before. Being a part of that business was really what has empowered me to get into this world of couch.com, which is a place where we are looking to solve the biggest problem in the furniture industry, which is quite simply that nobody knows where to go to buy furniture. So being in the executive meetings of a large, successful furniture retail chain, understanding their trials and tribulations with user acquisition and retention in a competitive market, seeing how they're adapting to this online first game that all of us furniture retailers in the space were playing, and then seeing our online retail trials and tribulations and how they were similar in many ways. And what I'm doing with couch.com is bringing that all together in one place where the customer can come and figure out where they can buy a couch. And we have special tools to help them do that, which is really the focus of our conversation today.
And what I think is super interesting, and just to clarify, I want to make sure that I'm not misinterpreting couch.com, because I've had a brief look around the site. As I understand it, you are not trying to build a couch marketplace or a furniture marketplace where people can sell directly through couch.com. You are an educational platform and kind of an advertising or marketing platform for some of those vendors that sell online or I guess in person potentially as well. And you want to be effectively the go-to resource hub for people that are looking at buying a couch or furniture online, as I understand it. So correct me if I'm wrong.
No, that's exactly right. At the time that we are recording this podcast, we are in development of our full-scale platform, which will have many attributes, including a marketplace that is essentially not existing to transact business or take the transaction, but rather more of an affiliate marketplace model where we are educating customers, allowing them to compare different brands against each other or retailers, and then we ultimately send them to the retailer of their choice. So we are, in essence, as you said, an advertising or marketing platform for the furniture industry. And that, in that respect, we are a B2B business entity, but are really sticking to our D2C roots in how we are acquiring users, building trust, and ultimately doing a good job of marketing so that we can help our retail partners sell more furniture.
And I think, I don't know what's happened in the last few years. It's been a couple of years since I've worked with clients in this space. When I think of the furniture industry, oftentimes these are family businesses, especially the independent furniture retailers. They're family businesses. They're legacy businesses. Oftentimes they've been around 25, 50, 75, 100 years. I remember Levitt's. I remember some of the big brands that I grew up knowing. When I grew up in Riverside, some of these biggest retail brands that were, they weren't public companies. They weren't big global behemoths. They were regional, and they usually had between 5 and 25 stores. and they dominated in their region. And I found this kind of model to be true in most of the other places that I've been, including Australia, including New Zealand, et cetera, where there's not, apart from the IKEAs of the world, for example, and apart from maybe the Costcos of the world, most furniture retailing is done by independent retailers and small chains. And because of that, oftentimes these brands and businesses, they are legacy family-owned businesses and they're run in a legacy way. And therefore, they don't necessarily have the digital savvy to get their independent businesses online and be able to operationalize selling furniture online, which is operationally, furniture is such an incredibly complex industry operationally, particularly from an inbound and outbound logistics perspective and return logistics perspective. It's just insane, the amount of complexity. But even the selling complexity, and I'd like your thoughts on this, even the selling complexity is just nuts when you are looking to build an e-commerce solution around this space, because oftentimes they, each individual product has a matrix of, it could have 5,000 potential variations of a single Lazy Boy chair, for example, or a single sofa. Because when you take into account the fabric, the fill, the legs, the color, the materials, it just everything, when you take into account all of the variations that can exist within one single piece of furniture, usually those SKUs are built out in store based on chunks of a SKU. Okay, this component of the SKU defines the fabric. This chunk of the SKU defines the color. This chunk of the SKU defines the feet. And what we have is we have effectively, you can have millions of virtual SKUs that you may not have in stock, but that you want to make available through an e-commerce website. So how do we do that in an efficient way that doesn't break the back of either our ERP, our PIM system, our e-commerce systems, et cetera? So these are some of the challenges I've encountered solutioning for this industry. And I'd love your take on some of the additional complexities of this industry.
First of all, that was a very impressive assessment of the furniture industry. And you just exhibited a lot of industry knowledge and insight that I'm very surprised and impressed by. Good job, Jason.
Thank you. Thank you.
No, really, you hit the nail on the head on a lot of those things. And there are certainly more complexities. I'll actually, rather than naming a few more, I'll just dive into a few of the ones that you mentioned. The logistics aspects of furniture, both on the inbound and outbound end, especially from an e-commerce standpoint, where we're most often managing a national distribution, if not international distribution network, where our customers are located. On the inbound side, I'll start there. Like, you have the supply chain, and the best example of supply chain melee that people like to refer to is just the pandemic, where the furniture industry is probably, the American furniture market is probably, I don't know, 85% reliant upon imported products, if not products, then parts. And when that global supply chain was cut off or shut down in places and parts or in full, the furniture industry was like, it made national news headlines. That's what people talked about. People in my life that were asking me. Luckily, the company I ran, we sold primarily an American made product, which was made to order, upholstery, sofas, and sectionals. And that's what we did well. So we made out ahead in that specific situation. But that's just a good example, the pandemic is, of how global supply chain can affect an industry and how complex it is. You're moving, you're sourcing product, you're buying based on projected demand, which fluctuates so immensely. That was the story of 2023 in the furniture space. Everybody overbought. By the way, if you're shopping for furniture right now and you're not getting the deal of your lifetime, you should keep looking, because everybody has too much inventory and everybody's hurting. So you can exploit that as a customer, I think. And then anyway, so those are just some examples of some complexities that exist on the inbound side. Just getting the product and getting the right amount of it, really difficult. On the outbound side, logistics is such a huge part of a customer's experience. And in the national logistics space, there is very little that has been done to address this problem in mass. And you've seen over the last few years, some really savvy companies, like one that I'm actually partnered with called Deliveroo, who is using technology and really like hinging the success of their business and operation on technology to make things better. Now, we can't move trucks faster yet. We can't move trains faster or ocean containers. So we are bound by a certain sort of truisms of the industry. We can't make delivery drivers be happy every time or not come out of prison within the last few years. But so certain things you cannot control. What you can control is customers' visibility, communication, transparency, accountability, right? This company I'm partnered with, DeliverRight, we use them in my former business. They have this proprietary software called Grasshopper, and it's so good that they're licensing it out to their competitors. That's what's going on in this industry. But they are basically like, you can't close out an order as a delivery driver without taking 10 pictures of the situation, of the product. And that creates accountability that never existed before. So anyway, why I'm going on this tangent is just to explain some of the complexities, because within the solution that they're creating, the problem still exists of, it's really hard to get furniture shipped around the country without getting damaged and with everybody being happy. Like, problems are plentiful in the furniture space, and it's really difficult to do a good job.
Yeah, even if the intent is there to do a good job. And then we have the other complexity, which is that, and my wife worked for a retailer in New Zealand for a couple of years where they were a furniture and homewares store. That's what they did. And probably only about 20 to 25% of the furniture that they sold was sold directly off of the showroom floor or direct to door by selling online. The rest was made to order. And so you have that additional complexity, and you have the timeframes of that complexity where you say, okay, I want this couch, but I want it with this material and this color and with these feet instead of what you've got on the showroom floor or in your 20 stores. You don't have any of the combination that I want in your 20 stores. So I'm happy to wait 3 months to get it, which is the norm. Somewhere between 60 and 90 days seems to be the norm when you have to import to order, which still seems to, I don't know what the percentage of import to order is in the United States, but I would imagine it's still significant because it's virtually impossible to have every single combination and every single piece of furniture someone might want somewhere in your chain at any given point in time, right?
Yeah, there are a lot of different models that I've seen work well and then also not so well. Like, one of our main competitors is a company called Interior Define, which is now back on its way up, but their business model was made to order in China. And which is great because, like, they figured out one of the biggest difficulties in the furniture space, which is margin and where to find it and how to make money, but also had to deal with an incredibly complex and risky supply chain, being that there was literally an ocean between us and language barriers and less control than you probably want to have over your supply chain. And over the pandemic, they basically ended up completely getting out of whack and had to sell their business for, you know, pennies on the dollar, got bailed out by a company that's now building it back. So that's an example of how it didn't go so great. And then there are other models where you make it stateside here in the US is what, like what we did, but you maybe have less scalability. And that was our problem, that our factory couldn't keep up with our pace, but we had such a good thing going that we were really hesitant to branch out into other areas. Again, we're just touching upon the many different complexities. When you start to crack open this nut of like how to run a furniture business, and it can't be that hard. No, it can be. There are a lot of things to consider, as you said.
And one thing that I'm seeing, not just in the furniture sector, but in many other verticals as well, is this concept of either dual shoring or near shoring as a result of the pandemic. And this is where I'm seeing AI start to come into play in certain industries with digital twins, with digital supply chains, with real-time tracking from factory to customer door. I'm starting to see some things happen in the industry where we ran JIT or just in time. Many industries and verticals and businesses and brands ran just in time supply chains pre-pandemic. I think almost everyone now realizes just in time is great until it isn't. And just in time is great until it isn't, and it potentially puts you out of business. And so a lot of brands now are running a model that has a little bit more flex, a little bit more give in it. And what I'm seeing this even in Mexico now, where a lot of US-based brands, where say, for example, they were 100% of their production was in China pre-pandemic. Now, maybe they're still doing some supply out of China, but maybe they're also doing some manufacturing here in Mexico, which is right across the border, where there's lots of natural resources and human resources here in Mexico to achieve scale. Maybe they're also doing dual sourcing from somewhere like Vietnam or somewhere else in Europe, et cetera, to shield themselves against those potential supply chain shocks, both now and in the future. And they're using AI. The areas where I'm mostly seeing AI really start to become relevant is in the areas of demand planning, supply chain management, and digitalization of the supply chain. And that's where I'm seeing as someone who's in this space, but I'd love your take on where you see AI really starting to weasel its way into the furniture industry.
Yeah, I think you just touched upon something that I've talked about a lot recently, which is just predictive analysis of what people are buying. And I think that is probably the biggest thing on the back end of the furniture industry that is leveraging AI to make some big gains and changes. And yeah, in the logistics supply chain, I already talked about that, like technology, AI, these things are making us so much stronger in that area. But on the front end of the business, I think you'll see a much bigger impact because AI is offering furniture buyers and indirectly retailers a lot more of an ability to find and get what they want easily. And we are building out functionalities and capabilities, leveraging AI as much as possible to help customers find their perfect couch. So two big ways that's happening right now are one in visualization. So as being an online-only retailer over the last decade plus of furniture, this thing that like literally everybody wants to sit on and see how it looks before they buy it. In fact, by the way, 80% of the commerce is still done on the brick and mortar level in the furniture industry. So there's a big opportunity for e-commerce to grow, and it's an interesting dynamic right now. But visualization tools are like the name of the game. And anyone that would ever come out, if I got an email in my inbox or if I heard something about one, I would vet. I'd take that call. I'd see the demo. I'd talk to the people. I'd make notes. I kept a folder of who was doing what. And we partnered with some very interesting third-party technology partners over the years. One where you can see how something looks spatially compared to other items was actually very useful for conversion. There was, of course, when 3D started being a thing, like 3D technology, we partnered with one of these big 3D companies that ended up getting bought by Williams-Sonoma. And then in just general AR technology and seeing how that's evolved, we were early adopters of all of those things. And none of them really were home runs. Like they all had flaws. Now it's different. And you see this like Wayfair, for instance, the largest retailer of furniture in the US, has this awesome product that they're still developing and fine tuning. It's called Decorify. And I encourage everyone to check it out because it's super cool. Basically, you take a picture of your living room, answer a couple of quick questions, or you click on a few things about what you might like, and it shows you options of what your living room could like. Now, in typical AI imagery fashion, it's like changing your wallpaper and your floors. That's not my house. It's a little weird. Like it puts that seventh finger on the hand. The things that you see AI visualization tools do right now, but at the same time, it's also replacing your couch for a completely different one that looks realistic, two accent chairs, and a whole new look of furniture. And then next to it, they're selling you those products or products that look extremely visually similar to those products. And that is something that has never existed. True visualization of products that you can buy in your room without some crazy VR headset or anything else that you can do in, not even with an app, you can do it in your browser. It's very cool to see where things are going in that regard.
So we're talking, this almost feels like a merging of two distinctive technologies, with the help of AI, bringing these two together, which is the idea of visual search and the idea of machine vision combined with generative AI image technology. And now we're stuffing those two things together. And now instead of having this kind of clumsy experience, which is in the old AR days with AR kit, et cetera, you would need to have kind of a blank wall in your, even when you were shopping mobily on one of these online furniture websites, you needed to have a blank wall where you wanted that couch to be, for example. You would say, okay, cool, I want to visualize this new couch on this wall. Cool, let's move the crappy couch that's on that wall out of the way. Then we can visualize that. And we can, using the mobile website, we can be on a PDP page and say visualize, and then it will take effectively a pass-through image through video in real time of that wall and show that product visually on that wall. And that was, I feel like that was a great first step, but there was a fair amount of effort required by the purchaser to make that happen. You had to really want to do that versus going into a store and saying, I'm gonna hold a photo of my room up and I'm gonna hold it next to this couch. I'm gonna say, will that look good on my wall or whatever? And so I feel like what you're describing is the next generation of that experience, which is to say, cool, I'm just going to take a photo here of this space. And now with generative AI, we can basically, we can pick and mix. Okay, let's take that couch off that image and let's replace it with this couch that this merchant is selling. And it feels like we're now in a place, and obviously we've seen that now generative video is becoming a thing and it's becoming extremely realistic. So as you scan across a room, we'll be able to, in the very near future, I imagine we'll be able to see an entire room full of furniture in our physical space that we've taken a predetermined photo of. So I feel like we're now at the confluence of multiple technologies that's going to make that virtual shopping experience just 1,000 times better than it was with any previous generation of standalone tech.
Big time. And I really couldn't have said it better. That's exactly where I'm expecting this to go. One thing that I think is very important and cornerstone to our strategy at Couch.com in general is to focus on other elements outside of the design and look of something, other elements that are actually important to an individual. And there are plenty when you're buying couches. It's not just how it looks, how it feels. Is it good for kids? When am I going to get it? There's a million questions. And one of them is, will this fit in my space? So we're partnered with this really cool application called Realize Design. And Realize Design is, we're working on like the full integration with Couch.com. But basically, in simple terms, you scan your room. It has an awesome, this is like a high touch endeavor. This isn't like a quick hit sort of a thing. But if you really need to know if something's going to, or what's going to fit in your room, literally, we'll scan your room for you. It takes 5 minutes, you do it. And then we'll serve you up products that you will see inside that room that you can be sure will fit, because we have all the dimensions of the products and all the dimensions of the room, and you can see it in 3D. Now, it's still like an AR type experience feel when it comes to the overall look of the product. In simple terms, it's like a little cartoony and a little bit analog or something like that. Just not as high tech as some other visualization tools are out there. But it is very powerful to see, oh, I see how this three-person sofa is going to fit on the wall. I thought I could only fit two people there, but I actually can fit three. So those types of things are really important. And then if you take that over to the other side of things, which is the other way that we're leveraging AI, is just really using it as a conversational tool to get a lot of information from users very quickly. We've all dabbled or used GPT from anywhere from a few minutes a week to a few hours in a day. And I think we're all getting more comfortable with this type of an experience. We're saying what we want and we get results. Is it always the perfect results? Not necessarily. But a lot of times you can conversationally describe what you're looking for and AI can point you in the right direction a lot faster than you could search on your own. So how that literally transfers to a website like Couch.com is we're building an AI-powered quiz, which is mixes conversation and visuals to get information from people right away. I'm looking for a black leather couch. It needs to be great for kids. I don't want to wait 12 weeks. I do need to see it in person first. What are my options? And we are.
Or I need it in a three-seater, or I need it in a three-seater with a chaise or whatever, right?
Exactly. And these are all things that theoretically you can go to Wayfair and you could use their filtering options and browse through, but it's really, we're trying to make things a lot easier and people feel a lot more comfortable in their purchase to increase conversion. And I think the way to do that is to make it much more of an easier touch point and an easier conversational, fluid experience. And that is a luxury that AI is now affording us.
And I think you've hit the nail on the head here. And I have voiced my frustration in more than one instance on this podcast about why, for example, can I not verbally have a conversation with Xero? Why can I not have a conversation with every piece of software that I use on a daily basis when, for example, when I'm ready to do a financial reconciliation in Xero, why can't I say, okay, I'm ready to do reconciliation. Go here. This reconciles with this reconcile. Why can't I just conversate? And then it just does everything that I tell it to do in a conversation like I would have with you. And I think we're getting there with search, on-site search. I think we're slowly getting to a place where we're just about good enough with large language models and conversational AI to be able to have these kind of conversations with a large language model that has already been trained on the corpus of product data and structured and unstructured and visual attributes of a given product. I think we're now at the point where, you know, site search started out as semantic search. So it was basically on keyword matching, and it was keyword matching with word matching in unstructured and structured word-based data and textual-based data against a product. Then we've gone one step further and there's visual search now where you can upload an image and you say, if I want a dress, and I say, if my wife wants a dress, she'll grab a image of a dress that she likes from Google image search. She'll upload that to a website and then they'll show her dresses that are similar. So we've got visual search based on the attributes of the image. We have visual AI. That's what enables that. And then I think we're now getting to a place where we're probably just about good enough to be able to have conversational search, which is what you're describing, which is, hey, I'm going to tell the browser verbally what I'm looking for. And then it's going to convert that into a series of matches between semantics of what I'm saying and the attributes of the product to show me something that's actually relevant to the conversation. And it feels like that's a very natural evolution of how we've searched as human beings. Hey team, I have a big favor to ask you. Please pause this episode and send the link of this episode to someone you know that you think would enjoy this content. Really appreciate you spreading the word. This is how we grow. We're not a Joe Rogan. We don't have big, massive advertising budgets, but we absolutely want to grow. We want to get the learnings from all of these episodes out to as wide of an audience as possible, and we need your help to do it. Thank you, and now back to your listening.
Yeah, exactly right. And it would be foolish to say that the product that we're going to put out is going to be perfect or that much better than what's already out there now, but this is moving very quickly. And if we are able to categorize and tag our products and our vendors appropriately, then I believe that we can leverage sort of the language model learning environments to create this experience that is far superior to your average online shopping experience for furniture right now. So I am laser focused on that and reading everything I possibly can and talking to all the service providers that are in the industry. We're talking partnerships. We're talking, how can we help each other? And we're all trying to solve the same thing. How do we make furniture buying a little bit easier?
And look, this is right up my alley too, in the sense that not only is semantic search getting better and large language models are making existing site search technology better, but I think that this new interface, this new search paradigm, which is conversational in nature, this feels like a natural evolution for the users as well. It feels, why couldn't I just simply have this conversation with the website that I'm trying to search or find information through? Why can't I just talk to it like I'm talking to a friend? And I think it comes down largely to the size of the context window that large language models can handle today. And those context windows tend to be pretty small. Otherwise, the cost to run that infrastructurally on the back end just gets so massive so fast that the cost is going to have to come down. And the reality is, we've seen what the share price of NVIDIA has done and everything else with the large language model, specific GPUs, et cetera, for AI. We're still at the very early days of this. And we're seeing a scenario where a lot of these open source large language models are outperforming the proprietary language models that are out there. And so I think open source large language models in many respects will probably get there from an efficiency perspective and from a cost management infrastructure perspective before the major proprietary vendors are going to get there. If we think of the large proprietary vendors of the Googles of the world and the AWSs of the world, the reality is I think it's going to take time for them to get efficient enough with their technology to where it doesn't cost an arm and a leg to drive these new applications on top of AI. But I think it's getting there very quickly. And when we think of how many hardware players are getting into the game now in a serious way to try to pilfer some of that NVIDIA market share, because they're seeing what it's done to NVIDIA's share price, it's a very interesting space. And this is moving so fast, even for somebody that lives in the technology world like I do, it's hard for even me to keep up or predict where this is going to go in the next 30, 60, 90, 120 days. So I'm sure you feel a sense of that too, working on the bleeding edge of this stuff.
Okay, first of all, Jace, you said you didn't know that much about this stuff. You are definitely, you're pretty dialed in, but—
Thank you. Certainly, I would say I have a broad understanding, but I don't necessarily have a deep understanding. That's, I think, the difference.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because how I was gonna answer your question is, I think I'm feeling energized by the fact that things are moving so quickly, and that nobody really knows the answers to anything. I'm also deeply focused on like SEO and content marketing right now, because I'm trying to build a new business and a brand that's going to rely a lot on organic traffic. And so both AI and SEO are changing so fast that there are literally no true experts who know everything about it. It's happening so quickly and so dynamically that it almost is democratized itself, in the sense that I, as someone coming into this who's been focused on selling furniture in a specific way for the last 13 years or whatever, that I have a chance to learn, just if I'm paying really close attention, as I am, to be a player in the AI and the SEO game. And nobody really knows. And to your point, there are a lot of prohibitive things that are preventing some of the larger players from jumping into it very quickly. So a lot of smaller players on the micro level are able to shine and have some success. But I don't think any of us are experts, but we all are paying close attention and are trying to leverage this new technology and the fact that it's changing so quickly to our advantage.
And even for me, from a content perspective and repurposing of content with using Write Blogger, which is an AI platform for content producers and content editors, content redeployers, now with their technology at a very cheap cost. This used to be very expensive. There's been other tools that have been able to do this for a long time, but they've been very expensive. And now at a very inexpensive cost, a monthly subscription to Write Blogger, they can pull in the URL of my YouTube videos, and they can generate a keyword rich blog article out of that using the script that YouTube automatically creates when it creates its captions. It's automatically creating that behind the scenes. It pulls down the full script from YouTube, from just the URL link from that YouTube video, and then it can create a full blog article for me. And sure, I might have to do a little bit of maybe 10% worth of additional editing once it's spat out that article to make it really sound and be written and read exactly the way I want it to read. But if it does 10% of the heavy lifting and I only have to do 10% instead of having to do 100% of the heavy lifting, that is a massive improvement. And so I'm now going back across my back catalog of over 300 episodes of this podcast, and I am now getting this system to create the blog articles for me, which I then upload into Squarespace to my website, which now is keyword rich for Google to index and to drive traffic to my services website. So I think this is AI is changing the game for everybody from an SEO perspective. And if you've got a large corpus of existing data, and in the case of the furniture industry, you've got a large keyword rich corpus of data in the form of descriptions and attributes of these furniture products. Man, if you've got that as the foundation to start with, and especially if you've got detailed attributes around, okay, is this spill friendly? Is this designed for domestic use? Is this designed for commercial use? If you've got basically the better the product data you have and the more detailed that product data is, as with almost any industry, but specifically around furniture, the better these large language models can perform, right? And but that's always been true. Even simple semantic search engines on websites have always performed better. The more structured data you have around your products, the better they perform and the better that they can match requirements or queries with products themselves. But it just feels to me like this idea around product data, PIM systems, et cetera, that old nut, it's still there, right? So sure, with using platforms like Ocular, you can automatically tag products with attributes based on the visual nature of a product. So I've seen Ocular work across fashion, for example. And if it's a short A-line blue polka dot dress, for example, it can add those attributes automatically in a structured way, saying this is a short A-line dress with blue polka dots, et cetera. It can add those attributes, but it usually still requires a human to at least review that output before you make it live. And this is the key, I think.
Yeah. So a lot of that technology, like what you described with Ocular, is being leveraged in the furniture space right now for visual recognition of products. And it's a little bit different. It's not as linear or as well developed as something like for apparel, where you can tell if this is a plaid shirt. And we've all trained these models to understand what a collar is. But if I'm looking for a welt, meaning like a little piping on the side of the cushions or something like that, is it able to? So what I've seen so far is it's not there yet. But once it gets there, in terms of being able to look at an image and be able to categorize it and tag it with many different things. We're talking to a partner that specializes in this called Renovae, that this could unlock a lot of things for a retailer and ultimately for customers, because it's going to help them find what they're looking for much more easily. The easier we're able to, on the back end, tag and categorize things, the better we're able to structure our data, as you said, and the better we're able to allow searching engines are searching people to find what they're looking for.
And what is on your radar? You talked a little bit about this, of what you're doing with kind of that 3D imagery and the overlay technology and the visualization technology. What, you know, is got you excited within the next, say, and again, we know it's moving very fast, so you may not even know, but what are you most excited about over, say, the next 3, 6, 9 months that you think AI is going to be able to bring to our industry, the furniture industry, that's actually going to be legit, that people can start using it in a real world scenario, as opposed to this theoretical pie in the sky stuff that a lot of these AI companies are talking about? Because it seems like a lot of companies, they'll just slap AI in their name because they know they're never going to get funded unless they got AI somewhere in their name. And so a lot of this stuff still feels very pie in the sky. In terms of practical applications of AI in the furniture space, what has you the most passionate and excited over the next 3 to 12 months?
I think it's an aspect of this visual search that we've just been talking about, because it's not really where it needs to be yet, but it's moving very quickly. And why I think it's so exciting is because I like the idea, and you used an example of your wife. First, you said you were shopping for dress, and then you clarified that it was your wife. But hey,
yes, no, I was whatever, very careful hey, on that one.
Whatever full time. No, the uploading a picture of a specific dress, you will get results that are very, almost uncannily similar to what you're looking for. And even just like reverse image search on Google of such things right now is very powerful. But do a reverse image search of your own couch for anybody listening, and you're not going to get anything that looks remotely similar to what your couch is. You might. But you might get one or two results that are somewhat similar, or it'll just latch onto the fact that it's white and it'll show you other white couches. And to a layman or someone casually searching or doing this exercise, you may be like, oh, okay, well, that's cool. And that works. But does it really? We're not needling in on the specific attributes that people actually care about. Wouldn't it be great to know if something like a shirt is going to fit baggy? Like you can tell if something's going to be tight or baggy visually. But with a couch, you can't tell how deep it's going to be or how you're going to sit on it. I don't know that we're 3 or 6 months away from this, but this is where I think this is going, where you can take a picture of a couch and the AI tool that is processing that image can determine whether it is a deep couch or one that is very shallow in nature and will show you relevant results based on other attributes than the obvious color or like how many cushions it has. It's almost like painfully literal right now, whereas we're hoping that it gets a lot smarter. And ultimately, people don't know how to describe furniture. You've worked in furniture. Did you know what a welt is when I just said it before?
No, I would call it like piping or something like that. And I think what has me most excited is the translational capabilities, because as you rightly point out, I don't know what half of the I'm looking at my couch right now over the top of my laptop, and I literally probably wouldn't know what you as a professional in the industry would call most of the components of that couch. Like I would just call it a leg, for example, but you would describe that leg in a super high level of detail. Like it's a cylindrical leg, it's out at an angle, and it's got these functions to it that you would describe in a very technical way, so that if you were talking to a contract manufacturer, they would know exactly what they were needing to make for you. But to the layperson who just says, I like the look of that couch. I don't know why I like the look of that couch, but I like the look of that couch. Or I like the way that couch feels. I don't know why I like the way that couch feels, but I can't describe it verbally, but I just know I like it. And so I think the translation capabilities of these technologies are what probably has me the most excited, because I can look at something and know that visually it attracts me, but I don't necessarily know how to describe it to someone who's selling something like that. And that to me is the key, because buyers are generally lay people. They are non-technical. They are not experts in the stuff that they're buying. And so therefore any piece of technology that allows that translation from the layperson's language to the technical language to get there for them quickly and bridge that gap, that feels like a massive win to me.
I think that's an incredible point and something that is very specific to the furniture industry. There are other industries as well. I know what cars I like, but I don't know what the heck is going on under that hood. I'm from New York City. I can't even change a tire. So if I was able to describe things in the way that I understand them or what I'm looking for, and for this translatable capability to be able to spit that out enough to find me data points that are relevant to what I'm looking for and ultimately find me the products, yeah, that'd be a pretty good thing. And the furniture industry definitely needs that.
Wow. Absolutely love it, mate. Look, this has been a fascinating conversation. I'm sure it's going to be fascinating to my audience. You are right at the cutting edge of this space. It's going to be interesting to see how couch.com evolves over the next 3, 6, 12 months. I'm going to keep a close eye on that. Maybe we can have you on again in another 12 months or so, and you can tell us what's happened to the site. You can tell us what new AI functionality you've introduced, how it's working for you, how it's working for your customers and visitors and searchers. And hopefully you'll be able to keep us up to date. Because I won't have my finger on the pulse of this industry like you will. But I tell you, what's happening in your industry is happening to many other industries in tandem. So, you know, what you are talking about is very applicable to other industries, especially where there's a visual component of that product and buying that product. That becomes really critical to people being able to describe and visualize what they want in their life. And so I'm super excited about this. I really appreciate your time. If people want to have a conversation with you about this and they want to learn more, do they just go to couch.com? I'll put the link to your LinkedIn profile also in the show notes. How do you like people to get a hold of you and have a conversation about this stuff?
LinkedIn's a great way. And also I'm a very communicative person. I love hearing feedback and ideas. It's what's molded this entire thing for me. I'm talking to people every single day and start to move in a slightly different direction or narrow my focus. So my email is alex@couch.com. It's pretty simple. I am welcoming any communication from anyone who wants to chat.
Love it. And we're going to save the conversation about how you secured couch.com. We're going to save that for our next chat because we're coming to the end of our time together, because I'm sure that's a very interesting story. So we won't linger on it. That's going to be the teaser for the next episode we're going to do together. But now, as we come to the end of our time together, I'd like to turn over the microphone to my guest I like to let them ask me one question, any question they like. It could be personal or professional. So Alex Back from Couch.com, what is your question for me today?
I really enjoyed the conversation that we had prior to jumping on recorded podcasts. The biggest question I have that I'm most curious about you is, what's it like to think about making friends and starting anew in a new city, in a new country where you were not naturally born there? I always think about that in terms of other people that I've observed coming to America, California, New York, where I've grown up, and what it's like to just start fresh. What are your feelings about that? Does it bring you anxiety or more hope and excitement?
It's probably equal parts excitement and stress. And it's probably not so much even meeting people, because I find that if you're generally a nice person, if you're generally a person who likes people and is generous with your time, and you're actually wanting to assimilate into a society, into a community, and you're not trying to be an island in that community, if you're really doing your best to try to fit in and to try to, instead of trying to change things, just accept things. That's the way things are done here. And if you like it more where you came from, then you should probably just go back there. And I think, not to say that you shouldn't try to make things better wherever you are in the world, but I think you have to first get to know a place, and you have to understand a place, and you have to understand its people, its culture, the food, the weather. There's so many things you have to get to know first before you should even probably have a thought or an opinion on ways you could contribute to that place, and hopefully maybe make that place better through your presence instead of just being a taker in that environment. But I can tell you that one of the most stressful things, and this is gonna probably sound strange, but for the first year that we were here in Mexico, we were traveling, and we've only just recently settled in Puebla for the long term. And so when we were traveling, almost every single day, I would go to bed absolutely exhausted, because the bandwidth that you use to do things that you think are simple wherever you came from, meaning which petrol station do I go to get gas so that I don't get ripped off? What are the local supermarkets, or where do I shop for these different things, from food to clothes to everything? Where do I actually shop? I don't know the names of these stores. I don't know which ones are expensive, which ones are cheap, which ones have good quality, which ones have bad quality. Where am I going to get ripped off? Especially in Mexico, obviously needing to speak Spanish, at least conversationally, so that you can have conversations around transactions. Understanding the money and what it equates to and what it looks like in your hand. And when a person at the cash register says pesos or whatever it is, you need to know what that actually is, and you need to be able to pull that out of your wallet and hand it to them. You need to understand and figure out how to create a bank account in another language. So you have to go in, and you've got to have these 53 pieces of documentation and copies of your passports and everything else. And the way that they do banking here is different to how they do it in the US or New Zealand. So there's just literally every single thing that you take for granted as being easy, straightforward, and simple where you came from, it is likely to be totally different wherever you go. There'll be similarities, but it is just different enough that you have to figure something out every single day. You have to figure out something new every single day. And that is the part that is probably the stressful part. It's just that things are somewhat familiar, but they're not familiar enough that you don't have to think about them. So going and getting our clothes washed, which is very common here in Mexico, it's very common that you would not have a washer and dryer at your house. Some people do, but it's very common that you wouldn't, because it's so cheap to take it down your clothes down the road to a lavanderia and pay the abuelita down the road to do your laundry, to wash it, to dry it, fold it, and then give it back to you. It's so cheap to do that many Mexicans, that's how they do things. And so to learn that and to understand, okay, in many Airbnbs, we won't have a washer and dryer. Why not? Because everybody goes to the lavanderia down the road. It's just all these little things. And sometimes you've actually got to Google them, because you don't understand why things work the way they work, or how they should work, or how you should interact with them. So it is those things that seem and sound so simple that actually introduce a fair amount of stress into your life until you get to know them, until you figure them out. And that's the piece, that's the challenge.
Wow. That does sound like a lot, but also very exciting and exhilarating. That's probably why you're doing it. So thank you for sharing.
Yeah, boy, I tell you, it keeps the mind sharp and the heart open, because I'll tell you the single biggest upshot of moving to another country and living there. It exercises your empathy gene in ways that you could never imagine until you're there. And it helps you to see the world through somebody else's eyes. And that is a gift that keeps on giving for the rest of your life. And it's something that people that grow up, live, maybe have kids and die in the same hometown that they were born in, they'll never have that privilege. And I don't take this for granted. I know it's a privilege that I'm able to be a digital nomad and live anywhere in the world that I want to. I don't take that for granted. But I tell you, it certainly has helped me to have a greater appreciation. My wife's Asian. I have many friends from many different cultures around the world. And it definitely helps you to also realize human beings are human beings, and we all pretty much want very similar things. We want to have – very few people actually have a desire to be mega wealthy. It's actually not that. We all want to have a good life, a decent life. We want to have a safe life. We want to have a fun life where we're out there having experiences, where we have our pets with us, where we have our family members, and we have our community with us and near us, where we can experience some new things and explore the world. Most people have very simple desires. It doesn't take much for most people to actually be happy, except in certain environments. And that's, I think, probably one of the largest downsides to the American culture that in hindsight I can see, is that there's a massive desire to keep up with the Joneses, and you don't even realize it. Most Americans don't even recognize that's a driver behind so much of what they do, what they buy, where they shop, where they eat. They don't even necessarily psychologically realize that driver of keeping up with the Joneses and being competitive, that they don't realize that is a driver of so many of their decisions. And it's kind of only when you get outside of that market and you live for an extended period of time overseas that you realize, when you go back to the US, how prevalent that is. And I think it does a disservice to Americans, because they could actually enjoy life with a lot less money if that wasn't the case. That's my take.
Yeah, that resonates with me a lot. I've made a lot of money over the last few years, and I think about this a lot. And I've experienced at times, not on a consistent basis, I'm not a rich dude, but I have experienced the best that life has to offer on paper, meaning like the best meals, an amazing travel experiences, living in amazing, nice cars. I've experienced all those things, and I value them so much less now. And I'm so grateful for that. Right now, I'm just like, about having good experiences in my life and a lot of the things that you just mentioned. So I don't know. I'm right there with you on that, and still drive a nice car, but only because I like it, not because I feel like I need to. And that's the number one.
Being true to yourself is the key. Listen, Alex, it's been a fantastic conversation. I super appreciate your time, and I'm sure my audience has too. And I can't wait to do it again soon, my friend. If you'd like to get mentored by Jason for free, head over to greenwoodconsulting.net, scroll to the bottom of the page, and click Get Mentored by Jason.